Hello and welcome here. I'm Clayton Pixton. I'm recording from Kansas. Susan is in Provo, Utah. It's 2023 as we record this. And we might say we're in the final winding up scene prior to the second coming of the Savior. We've got a lot to do. It's kind of a dark time in many ways, but it's also a wonderful and bright time in many ways. And if you believe, as Susan and I do, the truth has been restored to the earth and great happiness is possible even in this dark world. So here in 2023, we have about 8 billion people on the earth. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has about 17 million members on its records, which means, if my math is correct, that for every 1,000 people, we have how many members of the church? Susan, how's your math?
My math's not that good, but we might just be at the starting gate.
Hopefully so. There's about two members of the church for every 1,000 people.
We've got a lot of work ahead.
We've got a lot of work ahead. We have printed since the beginning of the church 192,000 copies of the Book of Mormon, which, again, if my math is correct, is about one book for every 42 people. I think we'd agree that everybody needs one.
Everyone needs one, and your math is good.
Those Books of Mormon are translated into 112 languages. And let's talk about dollars.
I think the church is helping the poor, those in need, wherever you look, right?
They're actually doing quite a bit of that. $1 billion annually is what they figure they spend caring for the poor and needy. Recently made a $54 million donation for the relief of vulnerable children and mothers.
I like that.
Members pay fast offerings every month to provide food, clothing, and shelter for thousands. They pay tithing, which is 10% of their income, to support the mission of the church. The church is supporting 71,000 missionaries, serving in 414 missions currently. Do you remember how many temples we have, Susan?
There's 177 temples in operation, 59 under construction or renovation, and 79 in planning and design, and we're just coming off conference where they announced another 20, right?
Exactly. And we have chapels and other facilities in a number of countries and territories, 195, and we have 30,000 congregations. It must be a round number. We have a bunch of students that the church is supporting. How many institutions of higher learning do we have that the church sponsors?
We've got 5 institutions of higher learning, and I was privileged to be at one of them. I think the flagship, BYU, right?
Yes, where Susan and I first came in contact. Speaking of those classes, there's 110,000 classes per week in seminaries and institutes. And Susan, who are members of the church today? Where are they at?
Well, I think what's so incredible, you can find members of the church in the halls of Congress of the United States. Oh, you can find them as senators. You can find them as representatives. You can find them playing NFL. We got Randy Reed there with Kansas City, right? And you just kind of look. They're NBA. They're Olympians. They're all over the place. They're your next-door neighbor, your grocer, your woman that you see on the street. I don't know, how do you really pick them out? To me, there's a sense of purpose, sense of happiness, sense of peace. And people like you talked about difficult times, they seem to know a sense of direction. Hopefully, any of you that have met someone, a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, you've selected them as one of your great friends or someone you'd like to emulate them and perhaps even their family.
Then hopefully we're being a good example. Some of us aren't always, but the church isn't a museum of saints or perfected saints, I guess, but more like a hospital, they say, or a school maybe.
I think we're all repenting and trying to be better. I think that's a hallmark for sure.
Yeah. So, are you interested to know, hopefully you are since you're here, how this kind of began with the church. If you are, you're in luck, because today, obviously, we're here with Dr. Susan Easton Black. I guess I'll say a word or two about you, Susan.
Okay, actually, interruption here. I think I'm going to move the introduction to Susan and me to the end of the podcast, end of the episode, because we've kind of talked enough already, and I don't want to lose people. So if you want to hear that, listen at the end. Thanks.
So without further ado, let's dive in to what we have for today.
Okay.
What are we going to learn?
Today, we're going to learn a lot about the prophet Joseph Smith, but I always think it's best to put him in the context of his background. And so we're going to start with his ancestors and move it all the way to his birth before we finish. Now, I'm a nut about family research and genealogy, but rather than take you through each one of his ancestors, I mostly just wanted to talk about one so that you could learn the great difference that one man can make. We're going to talk about a man named John Lathrop. I wish we had a picture of him. We don't. He's born in 1584, dies in 1653. And he's over there in England, growing up in Yorkshire. But the only thing that we kind of know about him is beginning in the year 1601. So notice by this point, he's about 17. He's a freshman. He's going to the Queen's College over there in Cambridge. And I guess why I chose him of all the ancestors, he actually graduated, Clayton, in 4 years. So by 1605, he's graduated, and through that process, you know how you try to decide what are you going to major in? He chooses to major in theology, meaning the study of God. And while he's majoring in theology, he's ordained for the first time to be a deacon in the Church of England. After the ordination and majoring that, he concluded he wanted to get a master's degree. So for him, it's not so impressive at this point, but John Lathrop, by 1609, he's got a master's degree. He's now ordained to be a type of reverend, a pastor, and he's given a small parish that he's over out in Kent, like a Egerton area. And in this parish, he's the most important man in town. I think he kicks over any government official, because you'd say for him, he's involved in the baptism of the babies. He has a courtyard, and in the courtyard, it's got the graves of several of his parishioners. And you'd say he's popular. He's a good speaker. You don't get all the clergymen's becoming good speakers, but he was. And he was such a good speaker that it was said that even the royals would come out from London to listen to him. And it appeared that everything was going good for him until you hit the year 1623. So you've got him out there with his own parish. He's a pastor. It's now 1623, and John's got a thought. The big thought that he can't neglect is the idea of separation of church and state and the idea of authority. In other words, the man who had earlier ordained him a deacon, who ordained him and who ordained him? And the list goes on and on. And so John literally spends a year thinking about it. He goes in the libraries there in London, meets with a lot of people, and basically the message given to him is often, leave it alone. In other words, hey, we've been doing this, we've got the Church of England, but John can't. And finally, he stands up in his congregation there as the pastor slash reverend, and he announces to the people that he believes there should be a strong separation of church and state, and that the King of England should not be head of the church and the state. And then the big question comes down to authority. For John, he forms an independent church Now, there were many different people forming independent churches, but for him, he met in London. And in London, wow, you're just right in the face of the royals. And at that time, there was an oath that people signed that the King of England was supreme in ecclesiastical, meaning church affairs, as well as temporal affairs. And so John and his group, they could never have their own church building. They just met in each other's homes and began to search in the Bible. What would it be like when we're talking about really authority, and what kind of church are we looking at? And they're coming up with such things as apostles and 70s and prophets. I mean, they've got all these things going. And unfortunately for them, one night their meeting is raided by a group led by the Bishop of London. And as many as 40 of their followers are now picked up. There's about 60 of them meeting. I would imagine 20 were pretty fast runners and could move it. But 40 are caught and they're put in prison. And John then is one of those that's confined in what they call the Newgate Prison. Sometimes they talk about perhaps he was in the Clink Prison, but they put him in the Newgate Prison. And while he's in prison, he will see many of those that were following him in this independent movement say, basically, what do I do to get out of here? And are willing to sign that oath of supremacy. But John refuses. And he stays there. He languishes in the prison. While he's there, his wife dies. He has 6 children. They're becoming wards of the state. Rumor has it they're walking the streets of London. They're searching for bread. Finally, neighbors will now bring him to the prison. And the children are now begging that they want to stay together as a family and they need their father let out of prison. John is still refusing, notice his integrity, to sign this oath of supremacy that the King of England is supreme in ecclesiastical and temporal matters. He won't sign it. And you got the issue. Here's the kids, here's John, and finally the warden of the prison extracts a promise from John that if he were to leave England and be out of prison, could he take his family and go to the New World, which meant America. So notice, John Lathrop, he's not your Mayflower man. He's not your Plymouth man. But in 1634, he's going to cross then the Atlantic Ocean. And as he does so, we're going to find that he's crossing on a ship called the Griffin. It's 1634, and aboard ship, he's the only man with a Bible. And as you consider his Bible, you're going to find that aboard ship, that some hot tallow from a candle dripped onto his Bible and successfully burned several holes in pages. John will ask the ship captain for paper and then will put it where the pages had been burnt, and he will write verbatim the words that were missing. So what do we know of John Lathrop? Wow, he's impressive, isn't he? I don't think he's wishy-washy. We can now look. You're going to see he's got a museum there in Barnstable, Massachusetts. He's buried near there. He will, in the United States, be a minister. He held to his original belief all the days of his life, saying that for him, there should be definitely a separation of church and state. And he's searching the Bible and to some extent trying to find then truths. And can those truths be found today in any religious organization of his time period? So why is that important? As we now look, you're going to see that John Lathrop is the name on the top, and that as you begin to go through, you'll notice that the name on the bottom is Joseph Smith. The issue I'd like to address, Clayton, is history by chance? Is it by chance that authority to act in the name of God was restored to the prophet Joseph Smith? Don't you think that's interesting? I mean, is it by chance that he just happens to be related to a man that is willing to go to prison rather than give up his integrity and his beliefs? So the part I'd like us to remember is John Lathrop. And then for some of you that see these charts, you'll see the name on the bottom are the two names we're interested
in. So that makes me think of what Brigham Young said. You'll remember the quote maybe better than me, but how the Lord had his eyes on him and his fathers for generations.
For generations, since the days of Noah, and that just kind of watching as, it passed from man to man. And so sometimes you wonder, were we born in the right family? I know my sons, I've heard them say it was the right family. It was just one removed, as the more successful brothers, right? But name on the top, and you always wonder, well, what do you pass along to your children? Do you just pass hair color, eyes, or is it this sense of what really matters in life? Well, you're going to notice that the name on the top then is John Lathrop, but now we see that the name on the bottom is Hiram Smith. Well, that makes a lot of sense because Hiram's the brother of Joseph. And Joseph says of Hiram, he could wish that all men were like unto Hiram, for his integrity and his meekness, his willingness to learn. We know that Hiram Smith, his brother, lives to be in the first presidency. He's a patriarch to the church, and that when Joseph is killed in Carthage jail on that same day, so is his brother Hiram. If we then were to say, well, what about Hiram's son? Does it pass on? And you'd say, that was Joseph F. Smith. Joseph F. Smith, when he was 6 years old, his father Hiram died. And for Joseph F. Smith, as he's now being raised by a single mother, Mary Fielding Smith, he was once asked, what was your childhood like? And his comment was, he goes, I don't think I was ever a child. He said, I think I was born an adult. Because by the time he's 10 years old, he's pushing and pulling oxen across the plains. But I think the story I like best of him that kind of reinforces this idea of the importance of father to son is when Joseph F. Smith is 28 years old, he's working in the church office building, and it's a history. And you'd say, well, why would a big man take employment where he was never good enough with Pittman shorthand that he could copy and then write out longhand and put into the church files various speeches, but he's just merely making copies. He's kind of like, you might say, a copy machine. And one day when he's 28 years old, Brigham Young comes into the historical building and he's walking through and he sees Joseph F. Smith and he said, young man, what is your name? And he said, my name is Joseph F. Smith. And Brigham said, I didn't ask you that. I asked you, who is your father? And he said, Hiram Smith, somebody that Joseph F. hadn't seen since he was 6 years old. Brigham Young became very emotional and said that he had a blessing for this 28-year-old Joseph F. Smith from his father, Hiram. Would he like it? So Joseph F. Smith put down his quill. Brigham Young gave him a blessing, and it's not only one of comfort, but he ordained him to be a member of the 12, meaning the 12 apostles, and he placed him in the first presidency of the church. Now, notice he didn't ask him, do you pay tithing? Do you care for the poor? Are you nice to your wife? Are you a good dad? What he's asking is heritage. So for those of us that think, well, it doesn't matter. Heritage doesn't matter. I'm like, get it. We're gathering Israel. We're gathering a family. And then notice Joseph F. Smith lives to be the prophet from 1901 to 1918. And then, of course, he has a son, Joseph Fielding Smith, who was dedicated by his mother to be just like his dad. Well, what do you think of that, Clayton? heritage matters, right?
Definitely. I didn't know that she had dedicated him to be just like his dad. I should have done
like
that with
dad.
My son.
Would have been good.
Maybe it's not too late.
I don't think it's too late.
No, he might be. He'll be better than me. I'm pretty confident. So.
Well, mine too. Okay, so then we look next. You'll see there's John Lathrop at the top, and then I'm coming down a little bit different line. But you've got the name on the bottom is Oliver Cowdery. And Oliver Cowdery, you wonder, of all the different people that applied to be school teachers. They're in the greater Palmyra area. Oliver Cowdery applies, and back then, school teachers actually lived in the families of their students. I personally am grateful I never had to do that. And I know that every student I taught is grateful, too. I mean, could you imagine? But here's Oliver Cowdery. Is history by chance that Oliver Cowdery becomes a scribe to the Book of Mormon translation? Is history by chance that Oliver Cowdery is with Joseph Smith when the Aaronic priesthood is restored by John the Baptist and the Melchizedek priesthood by Peter, James, and John? I mean, it's history by chance that of all the people that were in the church in Kirtland, that Oliver Cowdery would be with Joseph Smith in the Kirtland Temple when you get Moses coming bringing the keys of gathering, and you get Elias and you get Elijah turning the hearts of the fathers to the children and so forth. All right. Pretty interesting, isn't it? So if we looked again, we'd say, well, there's John Lathrop at the top. And then you look down and you go, well, who else is this? It's Orson Pratt and Parley P. Pratt can claim John Lathrop as their great-great-something grandfather. I mean, the man who will come to the United States, well, then just called America, seeking freedom to be able to worship how he wanted. And yet his impact, I've always wondered, what if John Lathrop had said, okay, give me that oath. Are you telling me if I signed the oath of supremacy, I can get out of here, I can be a dad to my kids, get them off the streets of London? And look at the impact it's had in the latter days. We know that Orson Pratt, he will cross the ocean 16 times to share with people, mostly in England, about the gospel, the restoration message. We know that Parley P. Pratt, when he gets hold of a Book of Mormon, he says that eating is a burden, sleeping is a burden. All he wants to do is to read that book, and both these men then become apostles of the Lord Jesus Christ. Then we look at the next one. There's a name at the top, John Lathrop. Perhaps some of you have heard of Frederick G. Williams. Frederick G. Williams was a doctor in Kirtland. He was a convert. He, at one point, serves in the First Presidency of the Church. What are we talking about? We're talking that a family is being prepared to accept the gospel of Jesus Christ. I mean, does it give you a different thought, Clayton, about your own kids? You go, here they come. what are they being prepared to do? And was it me, their dad, or does it go way back to somebody that was as wonderful as somebody like John Lathrop? Okay, if we look again, we say there's John Lathrop at the top. Going straight down, we see Wilford Woodruff. Wilford Woodruff, you get 36 days after he had arrived on English shores, he already had baptized 600 people. I mean, try and imagine that. Our missionaries, that's what needs to happen again, right?
Definitely.
But Wilford had baptized 600 people, including those that were prepared to receive the restoration message, but also two spies sent from the Church of England and a constable that came to arrest him. Wouldn't you have liked to have heard the testimony of Wilford Woodruff? You know, this man, he wrote journals for about 63 years. And at the end of the journal, he summarized it mathematically. So he summarized, I've been on this many, I've taken this many nautical miles to share the gospel. I've walked, I've been on trains, you know, kind of thing. And by the end of his life, he asked that all of his journals be brought to him. And he looks at the summary pages, he adds them all up, and he concludes, I've made it. And he asked at his funeral that no one wear black because he was so confident because of the amazing service he had given in sharing the gospel. Okay, the next man is John Lathrop, and it comes more to my era. We might catch up with you, Clayton, here along the way, but Harold B. Lee lived to be the president of the church. If any of you have been blessed in any way by food from any Deseret Industries or clothes, pictures, furniture, he's the man. He talked about what we need is we just need priesthood. And then we know John Lathrop at the top, and coming to the bottom, Marion G. Romney. Marion G. Romney was a first counselor in the first presidency of the church during the time Spencer W. Kimball was a prophet. And Marion G. Romney, I liked a lot of things about him. He was a real scriptorian. But one time he was asked, hey, tell me about you. You know, what does it say in your patriarchal blessing? What does it say? You know, why did you get to be in the position you're in? And his comment was, Lord doesn't give revelations to blabbermouths. So I liked that.
Meaning that he kept his peace.
Yeah, kind of kept his peace. He kind of knew that
meaning if he received something that he wasn't supposed to share, that he wouldn't? Or
right.
Is that what he meant?
In other words, you know, oftentimes some things are so sacred, you just can't share. Like, for example, I was writing a biography of just a wonderful man that had served as a bishop and a stake president. He goes, you know, I could really share some things, but I can't. And meaning that they were so sacred to me and the people that he met with and counseled that they would remain unwritten.
Mm-hmm. There's probably a lot of revelation like that that we don't have.
Yeah, I would think so. Well, you can imagine then as we contemplate then John Lathrop, you can imagine as we get closer then to the birth of Joseph, that people closer to him, they would experience the gifts of the Spirit. We are fortunate to know the gifts of the Spirit that were enjoyed by literally Joseph's paternal grandfather, his maternal grandfather, his own father, Joseph Smith Sr., his mother, Lucy Mack Smith, long before young Joseph was even born. So with that, let's just kind of, so you get the idea. We know the Lord is preparing a family, but in addition, the Lord is giving this family gifts of the Spirit. Let's look first at Aziel Smith. Aziel Smith, he was someone who had fought in the Revolutionary War. He was nicknamed Crooked Neck Smith. I've heard some people say, you know, Joseph Smith was crooked, just like his grandfather. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Do you not know that his neck was crooked and his head literally rested at times on his shoulders? And so Aziel Smith had a lot of problems, but I would describe him as his own man. The gift of the Spirit I find just fascinating was that Aziel Smith claimed that he had a revelation at a time when people in the United States were saying, the book of Revelations, that's it. No more revelations. And Aziel Smith goes, but I got one. And the revelation he received was that someone in his family line would revolutionize religious thinking. So notice he's coming off a Revolutionary War, that they would revolutionize religious thinking. Well, years came and went, and finally, when Aziel Smith is on his deathbed, he's in his 80s, and his son and a grandson, but his son, Joseph Smith Sr., comes to visit him. And when he does, he brings him a copy of the Book of Mormon. And Aziel Smith, much to the envy of me and perhaps you, Clayton, he was able to open the book, read the Book of Mormon without the aid of glasses. And as he read a part, he eventually closed it and said, "At long last, I know who in my family line will revolutionize religious thinking. It is my grandson, Joseph Smith." So you get, we've got gifts of the Spirit. Aziel Smith has got the gift of the Spirit of Revelation. So the question is, what about his grandfather on his mother's side, Solomon Mack? Solomon Mack, pretty interesting man. He has to be one of the most accident-prone men I've ever read about, with the exception of Wilford Woodruff. I mean, for Solomon Mack, not just once, but twice, he's looking over kind of at a mill that has this water wheel that goes around and around. And as he's looking, he gets dizzy. And not just once, but twice, he falls into the river. His foot is caught by the mill, and now you see him, now you don't. Now you see him, now you don't. Not just once, but twice, Solomon Mack is walking through a forest, and a tree falls and hits him. And you're like, "Hey, buddy, watch where you're going. Stop, listen, look, you know." Okay, amidst all of this, Solomon Mack actually has some money. And so he decides that he will go from doctor to try and find somebody who could lessen the pain that he experienced. And as he goes from doctor, he spends what he views as a type of fortune. And his conclusion was he's none the better, and that all doctors are quacks. I'm sure I offended at least half of our listening audience, right? But he becomes very upset, but then he makes this amazing discovery. The discovery is that when he prays, saying it in the name of Jesus, that his prayers are answered and his pain is lessened. And he becomes so excited about that concept that he writes this little pamphlet. Probably could have used a spell check, right? But the narrative of the life of Solomon Mack. And it basically wants to tell others that, hey, turn to the Christian faith. You can get rid of that pain that you're experiencing.
And his pain was from his accidents?
Yes, pain's from his accidents. And, okay, so look what we've learned so far. One is the family enjoys the gift of revelation at a time when revelation, we're all saying, hey, it's done away with. The family enjoys, at least in Solomon Mack's case, a lessening of pain when they pray. And then we look at Dad. What about Joseph Smith Sr.? For Joseph Smith Sr., one of the gifts of the Spirit that he enjoys is that he can dream a dream. And he so reminds me of the Book of Mormon prophet Lehi. He has a series of dreams that are actually written down, but one of my favorites is he has a dream in which he can look down on a valley and he can see a tree and he can see a rope running about as high as a man can reach. And so he grabs hold of that rope and he works himself to the tree. And as he does so, he sees that the fruit on the tree begins to open up. He describes it like a chestnut burr kind of falls off and he begins to eat it. And what you get, like Father Lehi, he doesn't want to eat it alone. He calls for his family to join him. The difference between Father Lehi and the Book of Mormon is that Joseph Smith Sr. describes all his family comes. And he said they began to feast on the fruit. They're eating it in double handfuls. Okay, notice what you can pick up from this is that a family is being prepared. Joseph Smith Sr. knows that his family will accept then the delicious fruit, the message of the gospel. We've got revelations. We've got a knowledge that we can have less pain. You're picking up the variety of the gifts of the Spirit. Okay, we now turn to Lucy Mack Smith. Of all of those that write of the gifts of the Spirit, we know the most about her gifts. And the reason is that she writes the history of Joseph Smith. And in her writing, a third of the book is about her. So it's a little bit misnomer that it's all about Joseph. But, you know, she wants it to be known, hey, she's in there too. But as she does so, she describes her gifts of the Spirit. For example, at one point, she is very, very ill. A doctor comes in, checks on her, and concludes, hey, she's going to die. Her husband, Joseph Smith Sr., comes in the room, obviously no counseling technique, and he says, Lucy, my dear wife, you must die. She asks him to leave the room. And then she said, I made a covenant with God. So notice Lucy thinks she can make a covenant with God and ask the Lord if she lived. She promised the Lord she would be a good wife to this husband who had come in and said, you know, my dear wife, you must die. But also,
that was the first thing she said, huh?
Yeah. Also, she'd be a good mom. And she then hears a voice that was, seek and ye shall find, knock and it shall be open unto you. So just kind of in summary, can you see a family's being prepared? Ancestors are being prepared. We only took one. But, you know, if I took a guy named William Stickney, we would then say, hey, he's a great-grandfather of Joseph Smith. He's also the great-great-grandfather of Brigham Young, Heber C. Kimball. And you begin to see this amazing melting pot as they're coming in. Well, all right, last. If we were to look at then, was Joseph the first child born to the Smiths? And the answer is no. Alvin Smith was the first. For all you single women out there, Joseph said he was the most handsomest man that Joseph had ever seen next to Adam and Seth. So for years, I held out for Alvin Smith, and hopefully I didn't make a bad choice, but Alvin Smith then was the oldest. And you get Hiram coming in, and we know something about Hiram and how he has a son, Joseph F. Smith. He has a son, Joseph Fielding, and then sister Sophronia. And then we come now to the birth of Joseph. And he'll be our subject now for weeks on end, right? But Joseph Smith, he's born in Sharon, Vermont. We'll learn more about that. In Sharon, Vermont, he's born on his grandfather's property on a 600-acre farm owned by Solomon Mack. And when you go to that farm today, you can see a shaft. Notice it's a real smaller version of the Washington Monument, but it's a total of 38 and a half feet tall for every year that Joseph Smith lived. So Joseph's born in Sharon, Vermont. He's born then December 23rd, 1805, and will live 38 years then, dying in Carthage on June 27th, 1844.
And for people who, we're showing some visuals here for anybody who's watching. If you're not watching, that's okay. Do your jogging or stretches or housework or whatever. But this photo of, well, is this a photo of Joseph Smith? Because I thought we didn't necessarily have one. It looks
right. So there's there have circulated various photographs that have claimed to be that of Joseph Smith, but you're right. There are at this point no, you know, official photographs of the prophet. But this is coming in off of a painting.
Okay.
So maybe for a momentary discussion for us, have you ever wondered who in your family line was preparing the way for you? And while you're thinking about it, I thought I'd tell about my grandmother. I grew up in a family where my grandmother lived with us. And she dropped out of school about 7th or 8th grade. And she had different small jobs around the house, but one was to see that I went to bed. And I would say to Grandma, tell me a story. And I wanted to hear about Snow White, Cinderella. I love those stories that end happily ever after. Though that was going to be my life, right? But she would say, I can only tell you things that are true. And then she would tell me about Joseph Smith. So night after night, you know, and you'd say, who in my family line was preparing me to do something different than I'd wanted to, right? At least initially. And I'd have to say, boy, you know, I'll cheer to my grandmother. I remember one time she told me about an ancestor of mine that had crossed the plains. She was in a handcart company. She'd worn out her shoes and arrived in the Salt Lake Valley with gunny sacks on her feet. And Grandma would say to me, so could you have done that, Susan? I go, no way. You know, I'd have to know who's watching me as I'm coming in the valley. You know, I'm just not going to be the gunny sack person. And she would say, oh, there's such a difference between you and your great-grandmother. You know, your great-grandmother now, she had faith, but you don't. And, you know, it kind of comes down to it, right? Well. It was pretty pointed, but sometimes those are the best learning moments.
Yeah, you know, that would have been an awesome preparation.
Yeah, so I thought for me, what about for you, Clayton, as you look back, your family, who's coming through there to make the way for a good student to, you know, to accept the truths and be a dad and still accept the truths?
That's a great question. I've got, so my mom was a convert to the church when she was about 18 in England. She's from England. Huh. And, we've got some cool, I guess, ancestors on that side, some reverends and cool people on that side. But I'd consider her a great pioneer, right? Because she was the only person in her family that joined the church. On my father's side, we've got kind of pioneer people. Robert Pixton was from England. My last name is Pixton, and he was a convert in England. We've got some converts from Germany. William Carter is one of my ancestors. Mm-hmm. He was
one of the early ones coming in.
He was the first plowman or whatever in the Salt Lake Valley and in St. George. So I've got some, you know, some mixed ancestry, but definitely some good stock, I think.
Okay, it sounds like it. So yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's like we can't be the weak link. We're passing along the torch to the next generation. Well, maybe in summary, what have we learned? Well, one thing we've learned is we're going to keep doing these podcasts and learn about the prophet Joseph Smith and hope that many will join us and that what they think is truths out there on the internet just might not be.
Yep.
So, you know, I've had people say to me, you know, hey, Susan, how can you believe this? And they say they have questions. And I go, you know, I'm sticking. I found so many answers.
And you know what I love about the Joseph Smith story, one thing I just love about him is he had questions, right? And what did he do? He went to the source. He did, you know, different people were saying different things, but he went to Heavenly Father, and we'll talk about that, I don't know, next time or the time
good,
after
I hope
or something.
Next time, yeah.
But people who have questions and are reading things different places, just make sure you're going to the source. And ultimately, you might read something, it might be in print and everything, but you got to verify that with the Holy Ghost or else you don't really know if it's right or not. That's, to me, that's the ultimate test.
Yep, I think so. Well, I'd like to close this session with my testimony. I know that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God. And I am so grateful for you, Clayton, to give me a chance to talk with you and with others about his greatness and what he was willing to do to forward the work of the Lord and help us get ready for the second coming.
Thank you. And I have the same testimony, Susan. I'm excited about this podcast. I think it could be really good. I've felt good about it since, you know, this idea came to fruition. And I just this doesn't mean you have to listen. I'm not telling you that, you know, since I feel this way, that you need to like this podcast. But I have felt, you know, I would say a measure of the spirit or a good feeling that I'd recognize about this. So for that reason, I hope that it will be a worthwhile thing. And I hope that you gain something from it as a listener. That's all I have to say. Looking forward to next time. All right, I'm going to play some music on the outro, and we'll see you next time and talk about Joseph Smith.
Perfect.
I guess I'll say a word or two about you, Susan, and if I get any of it wrong, or you might have to add some.
Make it sound good.
Things, yeah. Susan was a professor at BYU for many years. A very well-loved professor. Classes were always full. I took her classes back then. She's also written quite a bit, over 100 books. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I keep telling my husband if he were more fun, I wouldn't have to do it.
And 250 articles or so. So she does a lot of writing. You're retired now, but you've served multiple missions with your husband.
Right. Even a mission as a psychologist, so watch out.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I might have to keep you on the line after the podcast.
Okay.
And let's see, you lecture quite a bit here and there. I don't know where.
Right. Through the years, Have Voice, Will Travel kind of felt like my home was an expensive storage unit. Now I live in it most of the time, you know, since COVID, but had the chance to see the world and talk about Joseph Smith and other great leaders in this dispensation.
And from what I know of your story, I would say you have a gift for reading and comprehending very quickly a lot of content. So you just have this kind of vast knowledge, and you've used that gift to bring the kind of the truth and a perspective on your expertise of kind of the period of Joseph Smith and before and after to other people.
Hey,
does that
thanks.
Sound about right?
Yeah, that's about right. I had a crazy experience in junior high. I was put in like a closet with a couple other kids, and they had these old microfilm readers. You may have seen those. And I did well in school. One kid, you were sure he didn't want to be there, and then kind of average student. And they taught us how to look at a page and look in the middle of the page and read it. And then you'd take some comprehensive tests as fast as you could crank it. And by the end of the year of doing that, I don't know whether it was a gift I had before I had started it, but by the end I could pretty much look at something and know what was on the page. Anyways, great blessing for me through the years. Kept me from having to study so much.
So, I'm not telling you everything about Susan, but that's a start, maybe. We'll talk more, maybe, as time goes on. But amazing testimony of Joseph Smith, obviously, in the church. And if I was the Lord, I'd be like, that's my girl right there. She's carrying my name around like she's supposed to. So, we're very lucky to have her here.
Thanks, Clayton.
Yeah, real briefly about me, I'm just a guy. I don't have a special expertise in history. The reason I'm here is just because I've been in touch with Susan a bit. I took her classes several years later. I listened to the recordings from those and thought, this is a great blessing to me. And wouldn't it be cool if this was accessible to everybody who wanted to hear it? And so I kind of reached out, and it was several years ago, but here we are today, and it was just a couple of weeks ago, really, that I was like, Susan, how's that transferring of those old tapes going? She had some tapes, and she was like, well, nothing's happened with it, but what if we just re-recorded kind of the content, did a podcast, and you were kind of like the host? So that's why we're here.
Well, thanks. You know, this is Student Makes Good, and still a great testimony of Joseph Smith and making such a difference out there in Kansas.
Trying to. All right, guys, that is it. You made it through. Good job. We hope to see you on the next one.